from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear from two groups working to mobilize Black voters ahead of the April election. Then we'll examine how the pandemic has impacted parents and changed their expectations around work.
Working moms especially just became burnt out. And as a result, when those employers didn't demonstrate empathy, when those employers didn't demonstrate a sense of understanding, so many women said, I just can't go back into that work environment.
Plus, we'll hear from Wisconsin's Journalist of the Year and learn how she got involved in journalism as a fifth grade student.
Really, what drew me in the beginning was just the idea of being able to see my own work and my own name published and seen somewhere.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The April election is just 2 weeks away. Today, we'll hear from two organizations that are working to mobilize Black voters ahead of the general election. First, we'll hear from Black Voters Matter, a national organization that is working with a number of local groups to increase power in marginalized, predominantly Black communities. They do this by partnering with organizations already on the ground to amplify their messages and efforts and provide support. WUWM's Mayon Silver speaks with Alethea Bonello, the organization's Deputy National Field Director, about the group's work locally.
I saw that you're working with a bunch of local Milwaukee organizations. There's Black, there's Souls to the Polls, Leaders of Kenosha, you know, Metcalf Park, a lot of different organizations. What does that look like? I mean, you talked about some financial backing, but what's your interactions like with those organizations?
So we, as we said, we are partners. We have monthly meetings. We have coalition meetings. We're able to go ahead and share both ways, providing some opportunities as well as information that we have, as well as hearing from them. What are the greatest needs? What is the most immediate thing that we can do to support you? And then whether it be bringing the Blackest bus in America, the Black Voters Matter bus, to the area to increase excitement and anticipation? Or is it more so, as we had on February 20th, to go ahead and create a Twitter space where we have a conversation via Twitter to go ahead and talk about what's at stake and what was happening for that primary election on February 21st? So it's a conversation. It is conversation of needs, wants, and desires, and how we can strategize together to be able to provide the greatest need and opportunity for our partners.
And do you have evidence that that type of connections are working, like in a place like Wisconsin?
Certainly, we've seen it in Georgia. We've seen it in the other states that we've been working with. And yes, we believe that our presence there during the 2022 elections, when we were able to come through Wisconsin, did in fact increase support as well as voter turnout in Wisconsin and other areas.
Are you finding or hearing from your relational partners that Black voters are feeling connected to or heard or addressed by the Wisconsin Supreme Court candidates?
That's a great question. What we are seeing is that people are recognizing that the Supreme Court can have a direct effect on their daily lives. And so we still believe that democracy is on the ballot. We believe that the issues of reproductive justice, that there are voting issues and voting rights that will be coming towards the Supreme Court. And so we are educating the people to understand how this makes a direct connection to their lives. And once we're able to have the conversation with the electorate, help them understand the importance of it, yes, they do see the importance of the Supreme Court election.
So in the primary, Judge Everett Mitchell of Madison was running and people were excited about him. He could have been only the second Black Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin history. Was he a big driver of Milwaukee's Black turnout? And what does it mean now that he's out of the race?
I think regardless of the color of the candidate, the importance of who sits in that position on the Supreme Court is most important. And yes, I'm sure that Judge Everett did, in fact, drive an increased votership. However, I don't believe that that's going to decline because it is still very important that we turn out the vote and that they are able to elect the person who will be able to speak on their behalf on the Supreme Court.
So since its founding, the United States has systemically disenfranchised Black voters. And on top of that, candidates don't always do enough to actively engage with and listen to Black communities. What's been the impact of that in places like Milwaukee, especially when there's a crucial race like this one? And actually, I do have a voter clip from a guy. He's a cook in Milwaukee. His name's Chris. And these are two of the things he said to me when I talked to him.
I don't trust none of the politicians. So, you know what I'm saying? And they always say one thing and do another, no matter who you vote for. So it don't really matter. So I'm not voting. I haven't voted in since the Bush administration. So
that's his first quote. And then his second, he said this.
The politicians don't do anything to help Black people, for one. You know, and that's a problem because they do. I've seen them do other things for other groups of people, but yet they won't do anything for our community.
So how do you deal with voters who feel that way in Milwaukee?
Wherever we go, we talk about the fact of building power, and it comes in various stages. One is to be able to register, to utilize that power of the electoral vote. But the other is accountability, holding the candidates, then the elected officials, accountable for what they promised, for what they said that they will do in the community, and to make them aware of the issues and problems and hold their feet to the fire. So voting is only one part of the process of being not only an informed voter, but an active voter. And so we educate our community, our partners already doing the work, and they're talking to Milwaukeeans wherever they are, expressing that the frustration is well-founded, but there is something that you can do even outside of Election Day to be able to feel that you are not disenfranchised, but rather that you are empowered to do something about what is going on in your community, speaking boldly to the politicians, whether it's at a designated meeting or even on the streets, wherever they are, to ensure that what your issues are, that they are known, that they are heard, and that something will take place. And so we do that not only on Election Day, but we believe in 365, 24/7, that we are on the mark to continue to speak up against issues that are facing our community and to be able to partner not only with our existing partners, but with any and everybody who believes in the same issues and values that we have, to be able to make a change and to advocate, applying pressure to the decision makers in order to bring about change in our communities.
And in Milwaukee specifically, it's unfortunately, the 2020 census reconfirmed Milwaukee's status as one of the most segregated cities and metropolitan areas in the United States. You know, ending poverty, access to housing and jobs, health equity, small business support. Those are all big issues for improving the quality of life for Black people in Milwaukee and Wisconsin as a whole. How does this affect Black voter mobilization around this race?
It makes it seems as if the goal is harder, but it's not. When we are able to express what the barriers are, but continue to encourage people that we still have the power to move those barriers out of the way and to make a change. And so we simply dig deeper, we work harder, and we communicate the information and educate our people to understand, again, what we're about. Black voters matter. And when we say Black voters, we're not speaking in a means of an anti or against anything else, because we understand that the issues that face Black people face all people. We have American values and American issues that we are trying to bring to the forefront, but in particularly to those who feel most disenfranchised. And so we want to encourage Black voters to get out there, to speak their voice, and to be able to vote.
And then, do you know from your partners what are the issues that are most mobilizing Black Wisconsin voters or Milwaukee voters?
I think the same issues that we talked about in the 2022 elections, whether it be affordable housing, whether it be public safety, again, reproductive rights, is always an issue. This cash bail ballot initiative has folks talking a lot as well. And so they really are the same issues, just in a different venue and different time period. And then, of course, what's happening in the legislature, the
redistricting issues.
Redistricting, yeah, that's a huge issue as well.
And these things can seem somewhat detached from people's lives. Like the Supreme Court can seem like something very far away that people don't really practice in front of or understand or connect to. You're just relying on your partners to kind of get it connected with voters on the ground.
Right. Working together, united, we are able to amplify their work, allow them to go further, and to be able to reach more voters, to increase voter turnout, to increase voter understanding of what's happening, and to be able to overcome the barriers that have been taking place as it relates to voter rights, both federally, statewide, and locally, and that they too will be able to continue the work, not only on Election Day, but 365, 24/7.
And are those the limitations? Those are the big limitations, like voting rights? Are you stumbling into anything else?
That's the biggest one. And then we're concerned with these bills that are coming up. We want to focus on the most important things, as we said, housing, access to good housing, access to good education, public safety, being able to find good jobs. And yet now we have to deal with, in Florida, for example, AP African American history, and does it have educational value? We know it does. Why is that a conversation in 2023? And we want to be able to focus, or as we've said in the Civil Rights Movement, keep our eyes on the prize, those things that are most important to our community, so we can get to a better place and advance collectively. And again, these are not just Black issues. These are American issues. These are what everyone is talking about. Inflation, how that's hurt our people, and being able to talk about that. 58 years ago, we were fighting for voting rights. And in 2023, we are still waiting for the John Lewis Act to become law once again. So we want to focus on more than dealing with the same issues that we've been dealing with for over 58 years. Access for the right to vote. That is an American right. And it should not have to be enacted into law over and over again. So we just want people to be encouraged, to let them know that they are seen, that they are heard, and that we are on the front lines fighting for their rights and the issues that are most important to them.
Alethea Bonello of Black Voters Matter, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Alethea Bonello is the Deputy National Field Director for Black Voters Matter. She spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver. In 2020, the Republican Party of Wisconsin opened its first Milwaukee field office on the city's north side, where the residents are predominantly Black and brown. The office's African-American engagement director, Kenzer Sennett, says Black voters in Milwaukee are concerned about issues like the economy, crime, and education. The office is working to engage with Black voters and share their message about candidates they think should be elected to work on these issues. To learn how they're working to mobilize Black voters ahead of the general election, Senate joins WUWM's Eddie Morales.
The GOP had made efforts to reach Black voters in the 2020 election with the opening of its Milwaukee field office. How have operations been since opening, and what does it look like now?
Operations have been great. Once again, just wanting to make sure that we reach out to every single voter, in particular the Black community. Past times, we've never really been around, but now we're looking towards the future, and we're moving forward, and we're making sure that we don't leave any stone unturned.
How is the office trying to explain the stakes of the Wisconsin Supreme Court race?
by providing information to individuals that do come into that office, but also getting out into the community, building relationships with faith-based leaders, building relationships with business owners and community activists. You know, you have to go to the people to reach the voters rather than just, you know, staying put. And also our candidates, you know, this past Saturday, we had Dan Kelly over at the Bishop's Council meeting over at Holy Redeemer. And, you know, this upcoming Sunday, we're going to have him over at Bishop Hines's church. You know, once again, it's just really making sure that we do just reach out to folks in the community and meet them where they are. That's just the biggest thing that we are currently doing right now.
And when you are reaching out, what are the issues that are driving the next generation?
Yeah, well, in general, you know, to be honest with you, you know, with my job and the conversations that I have with leaders and just folks that are just voters or people that have never even voted, it's the same things. Currently, right now in Milwaukee, you have the crime issue. You have an economic, serious economic issue where poverty is rampant. And the educational side, currently MPS schools and, you know, just reading and math scores for our children here in Milwaukee are atrocious. And we as the GOP believe that we do have the better message. We have the winning message and a winning formula. And we're educating. That's what we can only do right now is making sure that we're educating and letting folks know what our message is.
And what are any issues? What are the issues that's driving Black voters in particular?
You can go back to crime. You can go back to the economic blight that's currently going on in Black communities and education once again.
You know, Everett Mitchell was a Supreme Court candidate in the primary election. And I'm curious if you know, was he a big driver of Milwaukee's Black turnout when it comes to voting? And what does that mean now that he's out of the race?
I'm actually not familiar with the campaign that Everett Mitchell ran. I can only talk on behalf of what we are currently doing. And once again, that's just making sure that we get our messaging out because we believe our message is the winning message compared to the past 60 or 70 years that you've currently had in Milwaukee alone of the contrary political party, that it's nothing's really changed. And all we want to do and make sure is that folks understand there is other options and we are the winning formula and we are the winning message.
And how does that work at the Milwaukee field office? What are the limitations of voter outreach? How does it work and does it work?
I believe it does work. From even going back to when I started this position in 2017 during the gubernatorial there for Governor Walker to even now, you've had an uptick of Black votes for the GOP here statewide in the state of Wisconsin. Even currently nationwide, you can even go back to, let's say, the 2020 race where 33% of Black males voted Republican in the Midwest. So once again, our message is the correct message. And I think it's starting to resonate a lot more with folks. And it just gets back to the wonderful work that our leadership with the Wisconsin GOP, and you can even say the RNC too, that they made an effort to make sure that we do engage and have outreach with minority communities.
Do you look at data when it comes to percentages of turnout in specific areas of Milwaukee, looking at demographics?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just basic, you can use basic public record, you know, just looking at the city of Milwaukee or even the Milwaukee County election results and seeing how certain wards that are in African-American community, how they are voting and how they're voting for our candidates. That's one way. But also, too, you know, exit polling that's going on. And it just gets back to the point of, once again, our message on the serious issue of crime that's going on, the failures of our schools that are currently going on, and also just the economic blight, once again, that's currently going on right now. I think our message is showing to these voters in Milwaukee, in particular the Black community, that we have the better message. And I think, once again, folks are resonating with it and starting to make that change.
Your office is based in that Milwaukee field office. Is that correct?
Yeah, it opened February, if I'm correct, February 6, 2020. We opened the office right there on MLK and North Avenue, 2244 North Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. Please, anybody at any moment, please come in. We'd love to have civil dialogue and we'd love to have a conversation to understand what the issues are that you are currently having in Milwaukee and how we can help as the GOP back in Madison and hopefully passing legislation and laws to make sure that there's a betterment of life for folks. Because that at the end of the day, That's all I care about, once again, is making sure that this crime issue is just going down making sure folks can have an honest day's living job, and making sure our kids are able to read and do math at grade level. I think that the opposition, the policies that they put forth has failed the Black community.
From the office's perspective, what are some of those outreach efforts like?
And I just wanted to go back to the past gubernatorial election, even just like, you know, having a cookout and, you know, just in the parking lot, having folks just come by. It was, you know, free of charge, nothing like that. But it's just, you know, hey, it's a Republican Party office, but it's a community-based center. It's a community-based think tank in my mind. Once again, it just gets back to, I want to be able to make sure that we can have dialogue with folks in the community, that we can understand where their issues are, and they can understand what our message is and why we believe that we are the winning message, and we have the winning formula. And it's being shown right now, once again, from 2017, even to now, that folks are starting to vote and they are voting more. So there's an uptick within our statewide races of the black vote for the GOP. I think it's time for folks, you know, to listen to the other side, our side, the winning message and the winning formula. I do believe that we have the proper messaging on crime, the proper messaging on the economic issues that are currently going on in the Black community, as well as the educational side too. We need to make sure that our kids are number one. We need to make sure that our kids are able to read and do math at least at grade level, and that's currently not going on right now.
Kenzer, thank you so much. Yep. For taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yep, thanks Eddie, I appreciate it.
Kenzer Sennett is the African American Engagement Director at the GOP Field Office on MLK Drive and North Avenue. He spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. The election is on April 4th. You can find information on how to vote and who the candidates are at wuwm.com/voterguide. In about 20 minutes, we'll hear from Wisconsin's Journalist of the Year and how she first got involved in journalism as a fifth grade student. But first, we'll learn why working moms are leaving the workforce more rapidly since the COVID-19 pandemic began. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In 2021, Kane Communications released research that revealed half of working women in Wisconsin were considering leaving their jobs since the pandemic began. Today, we're going to look at that report and examine one area in particular, working mothers. Only half of working women in the state have jobs that offer flexible hours or a work-from-home option. Add on top of that, less than half of women have jobs that offer paid family leave. The study also showed that women were quitting their jobs at a faster rate than men, and they were also returning to the workplace more slowly compared to men. To share more about the reality that working women face in Wisconsin and new expectations working parents face today, I'm joined by Kimberly Kane of Kane Communications.
All of these factors came falling onto our shoulders, onto the shoulders of working mothers during the pandemic. It is amazing, and I'm constantly amazed at how much working moms juggle on a regular basis. When you talk to a working mom, oftentimes they'll ask permission to not have a meeting scheduled at 7:30 in the morning because they have children that they need to drop off at school. Or can we minimize the number of meetings late in the day because I might have children that I have to pick up after school? But we really didn't think about, you know, how amazingly women juggled all of this until, again, everything came flooding onto their shoulders during the pandemic, when women all of a sudden found themselves at home, sometimes with global opportunities or responsibilities tied to their jobs. And, oh, by the way, they are also teachers for their children, caregivers for their infants, or caregivers sometimes for their parents as well. So they're working full time, they're taking on teaching responsibilities, and they're taking on all of the childcare. And that led to impossible expectations on the part of working moms in particular. And unfortunately, many employers didn't take a moment to say, hey, how you doing? Hey, is there anything else that I can do to help? You know, is there anything that's changing in your life that maybe I need to be aware of?
And working moms especially just became burnt out. And as a result, when those employers didn't demonstrate empathy, when those employers didn't demonstrate a sense of understanding, so many women said, I just can't go back into that work environment. I don't want to go back to 2018, 2019, where I am juggling it all. I need to have a little bit more flexibility and balance in my life.
Choosing between family and work is often a burden that is also placed on women, more so than men who are also parents.
Unfortunately, it is. And study after study has shown, even when working moms say to their husbands, hey, I need help with chores at home, or I need help with, you know, other domestic responsibilities, working women still tend to shoulder 60 to 80%, or working moms especially shoulder 60 to 80% of those responsibilities. You know, I think sometimes women need to take a deep breath and put their feet down and say, maybe I'm capable of doing all of this, but it doesn't mean I should be doing all of this. And we did see that begin to happen during the Great Resignation, where women began to say, if I am going to be at my best, and if moms, when moms began to say, if I am going to be a whole person for my family, I need to say no to some things. And hopefully my employer will meet me halfway. And if my employer doesn't do that, I'm just going to have to make a change. So it was a wake-up call for a lot of working parents. And I think women have to continue to say, we need to divide and conquer versus taking on the responsibilities all for themselves.
Well, these additional responsibilities do impact your working potential. And outside of that lost working potential, this report also looked into how this impacts the overall economy. So can you share a little more about that?
Sure. You know, one thing many people don't realize is we have more women working in the state of Wisconsin than the national average. And in 2018, the World Economic Forum really did a study about the impact of women on the workforce. And they found that companies actually do better when women are working. Companies are more efficient, companies are more productive, companies are more profitable because of the diversity of thinking and the diversity of skill sets that women bring to the table. And oh, by the way, they also found that when women are contributing in the workforce, the salaries of men also go up. So businesses need the diversity of thinking, the passion, the contributions, the skills that women bring into the workplace environment. Our economy then, if you take a step back, needs to have women working. Imagine about 50% of your workforce decides to stay home, decides not to work. How would our economy succeed? How would our businesses succeed? We wouldn't.
As you mentioned, the pandemic, of course, brought the needs of working parents to light. So what are some of the new expectations that working parents have in the workplace now, especially post the main waves of COVID?
I think in this post-pandemic era and, you know, in the talent crisis that we face today, employers realize that the employer-employee relationship is not a one-way street. It is a two-way street. And we need to create environments where our working moms and our working dads can contribute at their highest level and also feel that they're valued. Also feel that their employer recognizes they have a lot on their shoulders. So some of these things I think are no-brainers for employers. You know, first of all, get to know your employees personally. Supervisors really should get to know what are the nuances in the lives of their employees. And if they have employees who are working moms or working dads, have a conversation with that employee about what they need in order to be successful. If you have childcare pickup in the morning, I want to, or drop off in the morning, I want to know about it. If you have to pick your kids up after school, I want to know about it so that I can be respectful of your schedule. Let's have a conversation about what success looks like in the role that you're in, and let's create a schedule or work environment that enables you to, again, be at your best as a parent, but also be able to contribute to the organization. Some employers I also see creating a kind of a delineation between PTO or personal time
and vacation. And they'll say, these are days that you can set aside for vacation, but I want to make sure that you have a bank of hours that you can use in the event you have a childcare emergency. I don't want you to feel like you have to actually take a vacation day if you have to pick up your child from school or from daycare and then you know, get them to the doctor's office. So take a look at our policies and think about how do we need to modernize those policies so that they can be family-friendly or parent-friendly. And I think one other really important thing for employers to think about is there's not necessarily one size fits all. You know, we've always thought about the 9 to 5 or the 8 to 4 work schedule. You know, moms and dads can bring a tremendous amount to the workforce. We are really good at multitasking. We're really good at driving results through change. And so again, just make sure that you know your employee and have those conversations so that you can create as customized of a schedule as possible so they can be at their best, but they also feel they have the flexibility and they feel that you value the contributions that they bring to the table.
Outside of modernizing policies and adjusting work hours and schedules, your report offers a couple other ways to support working mothers. And next up, we have embrace and support parenthood. How is that a little different than simply getting to know your employee?
Yeah. Celebrate parenting. One of the fun things we did, Audrey, when we got the quantitative results back from the survey, I was stunned at some of the responses that we got. 50% of working women at that time reported that they were considering quitting their jobs. To your point, 81% of working moms said they did not have access to affordable childcare within their jobs. And so instead of just publishing the quantitative information, the data, we brought together 3 or 4 groups of working women who are moms, who are women of color, who are Gen Z, who are LGBTQ+, who could take a look at the data with us and then talk with us about how to create a workplace that could become a workplace of choice for women. And one of the areas that working moms talked about is they felt that they couldn't talk about being a parent at work. That, you know, at work they needed to focus just on being professionals. But if we were to create a work environment that celebrated parenting, giving them, I think, the freedom and the flexibility to talk about who they are as whole people, really took a lot of pressure off of their shoulders.
And lastly, there's focus on childcare support. And in a place, in a country where we're waiting on federal mandates, which we've been waiting for a long time, let's just say that. But when we need to rely on what can happen on a smaller scale, how should employers focus on childcare support, even if they're not capable, say, of like offering an on-site daycare or things like that?
Well, one of the things that we do here at Kane is we start talking with expecting moms and dads about their plans after they have a new baby as early as possible so that we can think about how we can be as supportive as possible when that mom or dad does return to the work environment. You know, we have you know, an employee who's going out on maternity leave soon, and a few of us are donating vacation time to that individual so that that individual can enjoy more paid time at home with their little one. So I think there are a lot of things that employers can do to be creative to support new moms and dads. You know, to your point, the cost of childcare here in the United States is astronomical. And unlike other countries, unlike Europe, there's not a lot of support for businesses of any size when it comes to helping new moms and dads pay for childcare. But we have family medical leave that doesn't guarantee any paid time off for new moms and dads. It guarantees, you know, 12 weeks of time off, but then you have to cobble together, well, how are you going to actually pay for that? So I think employers should have you know, an open and very positive and supportive conversation with new moms and dads early on. Talk about, you know, how we as an employer can help that individual during maternity or paternity leave and afterwards. And talk about any challenges that individual expects to have, you know, after they return to work, and see if there are ways that we can support them.
Well, Kimberly Kane, thank you so much for joining me again and taking a little bit of a deeper dive into this particular part of your research.
Absolutely, Audrey. Pleasure to be here.
Kimberly Kane is the president and CEO of Kane Communications. She joined me to talk about the Working Mothers section of their research report, What Employers Need to Know, The State of Working Women in Wisconsin. On Thursday, we'll hear from a group of parents about their experiences balancing work and family. The Hmong American Women's Association, or HAWA, is a Milwaukee-based nonprofit that was founded in 1993 by a group of 13 Hmong women. HAWA's mission is to organize women, girls, queer, and trans people to champion gender justice. They do this by providing culturally specific programming and resources for survivors and people experiencing sexual assault and domestic violence. WUWM's Community Engagement Coordinator, Rafa Munoz, is joined by HAWA's Education Outreach Director, Vina Xiong, to talk about the root causes of gender-based violence and the current solutions and resources that HAWA offers.
The following conversation involves the topics of sexual assault and domestic violence.
I'm Vina Xiong, pronouns she, her, hers. I'm the Education and Outreach Director here at the Hmong American Women's Association. In my role as the Education Outreach Director, a lot of my work focuses on, one, going out into the community, meeting with community members, meeting with organizations to share HAWA's work and services, but also to engage with community members so that we can reflect what they need in our services as well. The bulk of HAWA's work is around domestic violence and sexual assault. So we do direct services with survivors, and that looks like safety planning with them, doing any kind of like restraining orders that they may require, accompanying them to court as an emotional support individual, and one, really just helping them navigate the system as well in that process. And then outside of advocacy work, we also do a lot of educational teaching and learnings around gender-based violence, but also I think just helping community members understand our goal, but also how they too are impacted by it, but also how they can contribute to ending gender-based violence.
A unique role that HAWA serves in Milwaukee is offering culturally specific programming and resources for the Hmong community.
That's a very difficult part, I would say. The language piece in Hmong, there's a lot of terminologies that, one, we can't translate over into English, and even English terminologies that can't be translated over into Hmong, or otherwise it could be very, very wordy. So just the term domestic violence itself, it's very wordy when you have to interpret it to someone who speaks Hmong and only understands Hmong. So all the terminologies around that, but oftentimes our community member, and I think with the way our cultural practices are too, a lot of what happens inside homes as it pertains to domestic violence is very hush-hush. No one talks about it, and people normalize it and they treat it as something that happens in like married couples' lives. So I think just helping them relearn that, no, you know, that's actually not something that's normal to happen in a relationship. Yeah, teaching them those, but also letting them know what the signs looks like. And it's not always gonna be the same. I feel like culturally, there are different signs versus largely in the community that when someone looks at, or someone who's Hmong looks at it, they're like, well, that's not what's happening to me, so I don't think that's domestic violence. In every area or city where a Hmong community is based, they experience certain things from moving there to living there to trying to survive and build a life there, right? I think here in Milwaukee, one, we don't really have that space, not specifically for Hmong women and girls and LGBTQ folks. And so I believe HAWA is the only organization here focused on that demographics. Specifically here, we want this safe space so that the women or the girls or LGBTQ folks who are experiencing violence, but who also feels like they can't go to a family member even outside of Milwaukee here, that they can come here, one, help them process, but also give them resources so that they can, you know, go back out into the community and in a way, like, not have to face it alone.
Hmong people are an ethnic group with a specific language and culture. Hmong people originated in China and lived there autonomously for centuries, but they migrated to Laos, Myanmar, Vietnam, and Thailand in the 19th century to escape suppression and Chinese imperialism. While U.S. military forces directly engaged the North Vietnamese in Vietnam, the CIA waged a secret war in Laos. Laotian Army General Vang Pao, who was Hmong, recruited and trained Hmong soldiers with support from the CIA to fight against the Pathet Lao and North Vietnamese. According to an NPR report, American warplanes dropped an average of one bombload every 8 minutes for 24 hours a day for years in Laos, making it the most heavily bombed country in history. Fleeing persecution and imprisonment, Hmong people came to Wisconsin as political refugees following the end of the Vietnam War. Wisconsin has the third largest Hmong population in the country. What are the root causes of gender-based violence?
The Hmong community is still very rooted in patriarchal beliefs. So a lot of decisions that are being made in households or in the community is made by the men. And that's where a lot of the violence does happen, is the men are making the decision and the women have no say, really. And just to give like an example, like a family unit, right? The men, the dad or the father would be making the decision. And then if, of course, if anything happens where the father figure would abuse like his wife, then she can't even step outside of that home to tell her own parents, because they would just bring it back to him and say, well, what did he do? What did you guys talk about? And, you know, basically just telling her to be patient and to stay there. So in the Hmong community, Hmong cultural beliefs, I guess that's still so deeply rooted that a lot of violence does come from there. And then along with that too, just all the gender roles and gender expectations of what a Hmong girl should be doing, what a Hmong girl should act like, where what a Hmong boy should act and where. And so I guess that's also part of something that we do see within even the Hmong and Southeast Asian LGBTQ community, is because of those gender roles expectations that it's so deeply rooted in our beliefs that, you know, a man should be this way, a woman should be this way, that there leaves no room for even the community to be receptive of or to understand the LGBTQ, you know, spectrum and everything that goes into that.
Recent immigrants face another layer of challenges.
I know a lot of our refugee women, and I guess just like the Hmong community broadly, if they're not a U.S. citizen, then I think they do get scared to speak out and share their stories about that, because they feel like that poses a risk of deportation for them, so they don't come out and share. And I know something that we notice too with a lot of the women in our community is they have been brought over through marriage. So we call it abusive international marriage, where older men here, they go and marry younger wives out in Laos or Thailand and bring them over. And because they have been brought over here with no relatives, no resources, they're also scared to report anything that happens in their homes because they don't have any connection. They don't know who to go to. They feel like that in and of itself poses a threat to even their lives here.
Most perpetrators of domestic violence and sexual assault are men. I asked Vina if Hawa should play a role in educating men around gender-based violence.
A few years ago, we did have a youth program for boys. It was called Building Brotherhood, where we did do some of those learning and teachings with them. But funding stopped for that, so we couldn't carry out the program anymore. But another thing that we do believe here at Hawa too is that because so much of the violence does happen to Hmong women and girls, that we want to focus on that, and we believe that it is Hmong men's responsibility to do that teaching.
This is Rafa Munoz with 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Vina Siyong is the Education and Outreach Director at the Hmong American Women's Association. She spoke with WUWM's Community Engagement Coordinator, Rafa Munoz. Did you know that you can listen to Like Effect as a podcast? Just search for Like Effect wherever you listen to your podcasts to download and hear us on demand. Don't forget, you can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Like Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll hear from the Wisconsin Journalism Education Association's Journalist of the Year. Keep listening to Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Kajada Ba, a senior at Madison East High School, has been doing journalism since she was in fifth grade. Those years of work recently paid off when she was named Journalist of the Year by the Wisconsin Journalism Education Association. The award recognizes high school students for outstanding work in journalism and comes with a $1,000 scholarship. Ba joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more of her story.
Now, how long have you been engaging in journalism?
I first encountered or got involved with journalism when I was in fifth grade after joining the Simpson Free Press. So it's been around 7 years.
That is a very long time for such a young woman. What really drew you to journalism, especially at, you know, as a fifth grader?
Starting out at the Simpson Free Press, I did not know exactly what to expect. I didn't even know that there was something that existed like that, where people so young could write and be published in, you know, an actual newspaper. But really what drew me in the beginning was just the idea of being able to see my own work and my own name published and seen somewhere. At the time, I wasn't very confident in my writing skills and how I could use my writing to tell stories. It just wasn't very concise. It was very wordy. It was very rambly, long. And Simpson Street and getting involved in journalism was another way for me to practice that outside of school and improve my writing and my communication skills.
What are the stories that you like to tell in your work?
The stories that I love to tell the most are stories about the people in my community, people that I can meet and speak to and ask questions and learn from. I've had the opportunity to write features about businesses and organizations and different events that happen around the city, or even news pieces that involve community members. Those are really my favorites because they expose me to the different perspectives that exist here in Madison, which a lot of the time can seem like a bubble. And getting out there and speaking to people and being able to capture, learning how to capture their stories, you know, pops that bubble.
As part of what you do now, you also work with other kids, often younger kids, helping them learn how to engage with journalism. Why is this something you've chosen to do?
I chose my role in working with young people because I remember what it was to be in their shoes and, you know, just first being exposed to the possibilities of what journalism as early on as it was could be. And a lot of these kids might not be interested in journalism. I wasn't when I first got started at Simpson Street. But, you know, working with a lot of the older students there is what showed me that there's a world out there of things and people that I could be. And I owe a lot to them, the teen editors that were there when I was first starting out. But there's also just something so special about working with children and, you know, learning through their eyes is what I kind of like to think about it as, you know, talking through their articles with them and hearing how passionate they are about reptiles or about historical events. They're just a plethora of different topics and subjects that these kids are truly just immersed in. And I love hearing the excitement in their voices and working with them to really bring their ideas into their pieces.
Now, you've been recognized as the Wisconsin Journalist of the Year. What does that mean to you?
So I'm just really excited to be able to share with everyone the excitement that comes with this honor. And I just hope that I can continue my work as a journalist beyond just the title.
So you will be graduating pretty soon here. What are you hoping to do in the future?
Well, I'm hoping to pursue journalism. I'm not exactly quite sure where, but you know, with that, and I know there are many channels that that journalism can take you, whether that's print or broadcast. But right now, I'm thinking of mostly about print journalism, which is a dying art now, but hopefully we can find a resurgence in the appreciation and the necessity of print journalism. And with that, also thinking about maybe starting my own publication for people to share their ideas and their perspectives and their skills and talents, just opening up more platforms for people to communicate with one another, like so many of the publications that I've worked with have done for their communities.
Well, Kajada, I look forward to seeing what the world has in store for you and what you have in store for the world. Thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
And thank you.
Kajada Ba is a senior at Madison East High School, and she was named Journalist of the Year by the Wisconsin Journalism Education Association. Ba spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. You won't hear Lake Effect at our normal time tomorrow. Instead, we'll be bringing you a special report from NPR's Leila Fadel that looks at the impact of the first year of the war in Ukraine. That'll be tomorrow at noon, but join us again on Thursday for new community conversations here on Lake Effect. That's only right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.